Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Bath University's Matthew Alford is here. He's done a book on the British Empire, The Bullies of the World. It's called Union Jackboot, What Your Media and Professors Don't Tell You About British Foreign Policy. Amazingly, it's a comedy book. Also, former detective John Wedger from the Metropolitan Police. He's done decades of investigations into paedophiles. He was so good that he got the sack, and he's now helping survivors. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Matthew Alford. I'm a teaching fellow at the University of Bath. I'm also active on the local comedy circuit, and I'm author of various books, including National Security Cinema, Writer with No Hands, which was also a film, and most recently, Union Jackboot, What Your Media and Professors Don't Tell You About British Foreign Policy.
Well, that's a bit provocative, isn't it? Because you're at the university and you're saying this is what your professors won't tell you.
Oh, yeah, I didn't really think of that. Kind of, yeah. But I mean, like, I think the our department at the University of Bath is very much focused on Europe, and they are a very good department, obviously. But the I think this in this case, we're looking at the sort of prevailing ideology that is quite blind to the sort of nefarious nature of British power and the extent to which it is covering the globe still as a kind of vestiges of empire.
So what department is it?
My department is the politics department, and I've also worked in the sociology department there. And I work for various different universities.
Okay, so what is it our professors are not telling us?
Well, I think there's lots of things, really. It's. I mean, I'm not saying that all professors don't do that. I'm not saying that any particular university should be singled out for being bad at that in any way. I'm just suggesting, or we are suggesting, that there are lots of things about British power that do not come across that well in the media and are not emphasised within academia. So, for example, the fact that the British are involved in training the Burmese army, the fact that the British government has signed licences to allow the sale of weapons to a lot of very peculiar countries, including North Korea, the understatement of Britain's involvement in supporting Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen, for example, and all those kind of things add up to a picture of British power which is a lot more dangerous than is presented.
So are those things officially known about? Because I know there's a sort of two sides to the projection of power. There's one which is very much in the public eye, you know, things like Foreign Affairs Select Committees, these sorts of things. I suppose even very obvious wars where our troops are going over there and we're very open about it. But what about the more covert stuff? That's the more interesting, I think. It isn't officially even happening.
Yeah, a lot of the details of this are more Tim's area because he's the expert in British foreign policy. I'm the person in this book who is asking Tim a bunch of common sense questions about British power, and he's responding in detail. And then he's gone through that to fact check and to source everything. So in a way, I'm kind of someone who's I'm a co-author of the book, but I'm someone who's sort of promoting the book. So some of those examples there, you're completely right that the British are involved in all sorts of different countries, including places like Sri Lanka, for example, sort of arming and training both sides of
that. How do they manage to smuggle this past Parliament then? Doesn't Parliament get a say, I suppose? We're told they're sovereign, aren't we? We keep being told that they're making all the decisions, and yet it seems that this is happening, taxpayers' money's going on it, etc., and there's no questions asked. Please, you know, look the other way.
I think what happens is that all of this information is out officially, but it's out in government documentation, which is then poorly reported or not reported by the media. And so you do have select committees who mention these things. It's the same thing like with, so for instance, British arming of different sides in the Syrian conflict. I mean, that is known about through parliamentary select committees. It's just that it's not well publicised, it's not well discussed.
Sounds like what you're saying is really this is all the media's fault and that they're just not looking in all the right places, and there are certain, maybe people are thinking to themselves, well, if I look into this, maybe I won't have a job next week.
If the media looked into it, if particular journalists looked into it, do you mean? I think they could do. I mean, there are cases where journalists do step outside of their boundaries.
It must be difficult to report on Burma or Yemen without saying anything about the British being involved in arming, you know, the Burmese army. You know, this is pretty, you know, explosive. And the same with the Saudis in Yemen. We've got this charitable aid program in Yemen. I mean, I see why a comedian might find this quite useful material. A charity aid program to help the people of Yemen whilst at the same time helping bomb them.
Yeah, well, it's obviously peculiar. And these things are reported, but there's just no emphasis put on them. And as you indicate there, you can see the absurdity of that. I mean, I've heard on the radio a couple of things about Yemen recently, which was, you know, the British government were talking about, you know, we are coordinating efforts on the ground to aid with the conflict there, but we're not in an alliance with Saudi Arabia. Now, they can say those two things in the same breath, but they're extremely contradictory. I mean, they're basically saying, you know, they just won't call it an alliance with Saudi Arabia because they know that it sounds really bad to do that. But so, they are still effectively supporting that war as well as, of course, arming it.
So calling it a jackboot, that's a sort of Nazi phrase. Is that just clickbait? Is there any real justification for that?
I think that kind of mentality among some policymakers and some of the things that we've done around the world are not comparative to what the Nazis did in the concentration camps, which we point out very clearly in the book. It was an extreme, peculiar twist on a twisted version of humanity. But that kind of cold-hearted and cynical divide-and-rule imperialism-style approach to the world is kind of fascistic.
I mean, doesn't it happen to all dying empires? I mean, any big empire, as it sort of realises, oh, we're not as big as we used to be, they're going to get a bit annoyed about it and try and, you know, throw their weight around a bit, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're doing it, you know, all great powers do it and all powerful countries do it. And so I'm not saying that Britain is any different to any other great power in that regard. It's just that, you know, we're British, so we're kind of responsible for what the British government do. There's sort of a moral thing there. But yeah, it's something that I think should be addressed and highlighted a bit more by the press.
Okay, so a lot of the press comes in for a lot of criticism here, the mass media, hopefully not us in your book particularly. But yeah. Are there any places to go to get what I suppose people would need, which is kind of even just once a week, a look at what's really going on rather than what they want you to know?
I think anyone who's looking at alternative media can find information.
Come on, I'm going to push you here, right? What do you look at? Where do you go to find out what's really going on?
I use ZNet, for example, in the States. Antiwar.com is very good, compiles very good stories, information. Those would be two really good examples. SpyCulture.com is really good for my more specific area of interest, which is about government and military manipulation of the entertainment system. So all those things are out there.
I don't know if you've come across a guy called De Saker. We had an interview with him. He's a former NATO military advisor who was saying a few things that they didn't want to hear, and he got shoved out on his elbow. He lives in Florida. But he's said that today 85% of warfare is psychological warfare. So the mass media is used for 85% of warfare. In other words, to basically prepare people for things that their governments and other governments might do, and also to demonise some individuals, governments, countries, etc. 15% of that then apparently is economic warfare of what's left. And then I think it's a final 5 or 10%, whatever it works out as, is actual fighting. Do you think that's a fair comment, or is it an exaggeration? 85%.
It sounds about
psychological.
Right. It sounds about right to me, because I think that the whole history of PR, which has been going on for the last 100 years, would reflect that same kind of idea that governments realised that it was very difficult to just use the bludgeon, and that they had to start manipulating information much more effectively. Couldn't just go to war at the drop of a hat. And I think that's become increasingly the case, that it's hard for empires, whether that's the United States or ours or whatever, to use violence. They have to use manipulation instead.
They get bad PR for doing that, don't they?
Well, they do, but
unless they can manage that PR.
It depends the extent to which that actually affects what they can do, though. And I'm not sure how much it does. So the good example of that would be the Iraq War, where they were able to go in despite getting very, very bad PR about the whole thing at the time and, of course, subsequently. And there's a bit of a toss-up there, I think, as to whether the extent to which that's an issue, because, you know, the bad PR that they got from that probably did dissuade those governments from also engaging in a war with Iran, for example, afterwards. But it wasn't sufficient to stop the initial conflict.
There's another thing which occurs to me, which is this whole idea of the lose scenario. Quite a lot of these wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., etc., it seems that the West hasn't actually managed to win those wars. Even when we had George Bush on an aircraft carrier saying, oh, it's okay, the war's won now, it then dragged on for another 10 years or so. Is it feasible to go into a war without actually intending to win?
Without actually intending to win? It depends. Well,
that's what it seems to be. Afghanistan seems like, well, you know, we went there, we did something, but we didn't win, but never mind.
I think you'd have to ask what the maximal and minimal objectives were. I mean, it's like with Vietnam, isn't it? Everyone says that the United States lost in Vietnam, and in a sense they did, but they kind of achieved their minimal objectives, which was to destroy a country and prevent nationalism or socialism in that particular area from flourishing. Now, that sounds a bit of a mean way of looking at it. But
it certainly is. I mean, I've seen there's a book out by Dan Glazebrook, the Oxford guy, called Divide and Ruin. Do you think that's where we are?
I think that is a fair way of looking at the mentality of many people and many of the institutions that are running empires, yes.
Matthew Alford, author of, well, along with TJ Coles, of Union Jackboot, What Your Media and Professors Don't Tell You About British Foreign Policy. Thanks very much for joining us. And more power to your elbow, Matthew, for turning it into comedy. Well done.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The following interview with former Detective Constable John Wedger contains some harrowing material. If you've got children around, you may wish to turn down the radio or turn to a different channel now.
My name is John Wedger. I served 25 years with the Metropolitan Police, majority as a detective, and then I specialised into child abuse investigations. I joined beginning of the 1990s. Right, now I started off in South East London, like all officers, I started off in uniform on patrol on the beat, and then I moved to Central London quite quickly, and then went into the CID, which is where I really wanted my career to go. I sort of moved to a specialist department very early in my service. I specialised, which I did that really on hard work and merit. And it was whilst on this unit, I was asked to look into, the first time I really sort of come across this crime was paedophiles, but paedophiles that had evaded capture from the Sex Offenders Registry Act, which had come into effect in 1997, and a lot of them were going missing. So they wanted someone to sort of track down transient paedophiles, but in a specific environment. And these are ones that had gone to live on canal boats. So that was my first really insight into this line of work. Very interesting stuff. But then what I found was they told me that the information they'd received from the prison service was that there was two paedophiles that had left prison and gone to hide on canal boats. So I was asked to try and locate two of them, and if I could find two more within a few months of doing it, then they'd be happy. What happened within the first month, I found 90. And very quickly, that operation, despite its success, was shut down.
Now, how did you go, John, about identifying a paedophile on a canal boat? I mean, you know, surely some of that could be false accusations against some of these people.
Yeah, I mean, the police work on information, right? They're not really the all-CNI people think. A lot of it comes from sources of information. Now, that might be public, That might be other criminals, or it could be registered informants, anyone really. But there were some names were supplied. It was suspected of living on a boat. So I literally walked the complete sort of towpath of all the canals and inland sort of waterways within London. And there is a loophole that allows them to do it in London. I can explain that, but it's sort of a bit lengthy. But the other thing was just old-fashioned police work, and with a bit of covert work put in, and really sort of getting it in amongst the community, which on the whole back then was a bit of an alternative society and a very anti-police. So there was quite a few covert methods were used. But then,
You're not going to get very far wearing your uniform, I shouldn't imagine.
No, not at all, not at all. But without going too much into the mythology of it, I managed to sort of integrate into the community, as it were, and then I would get names of people. And then, because you could register a boat in any name, you could register it in a made-up name, Mickey Mouse, or whatever you wanted, really. But then you get the name of the person, and then with that, you could then near enough ascertain a date of birth. And you'd use indices to search on people, and then you could identify someone had a conviction for a sex offence. And you started then seeing a pattern of certain people were living in certain areas on boats, but then they would have involvement with things like outreach groups and taking children for respite care. There was one fella, a very benevolent paedophile he was taking special needs kids out for respite. And, you know, it was absolutely unbelievable. So it was tracking them down. But also what you had was quite a hippie mentality in some of these areas. And there was people that sort of dropped out of society, and then they all sort of got together in a community. But then they sort of literally trusted everyone because everyone else was a boater. And there was one fella that was a very dangerous paedophile that was actually having a babysitting service. And these people were happy to leave this man with their children. And he was an incredibly dangerous guy. And they'd gone unchecked for years and years and years.
So what years are we talking about, John?
When I was looking at this, it was beginning of 2000. And like I said, it was highly successful. And I had the backing of the Central Paedophile Unit. They were really supportive. And we managed to actually get the Sex Offenders Registry Act changed, that get the law changed to make it more difficult, because of this loophole they was using to reside on the canals and live there with anonymity.
But you said your investigation was closed down. How did that happen? I mean, you should get a medal, you know, not have the investigation closed down. You've been so successful.
Well, the thing is with it, Tony, this is the first time I really sort of got involved with what is demonised by the word conspiracy, and it's not. To conspire is in statute law. The only people that can't conspire are husband and wife. So you see conspiracy all the time on the statutes, you know, conspiracy for armed robbery, for murder, for theft, for robbery and everything. So it's been a nonsense. But what happened? A detective, a very senior detective, not in rank but in experience, from Scotland Yard's paedophile unit, approached me and said, look, I need to talk to you, because he said, in any other form of policing, when you're very good, you get promoted. When you're good at this work, they don't like it. And he said, I'm hearing your name mentioned quite a bit in Scotland Yard. He said, be careful. He then went on to tell me about a prominent politician back in the day that they'd investigated twice for sex offences against young boys. And on each occasion, they were warned and shut down. So he said, make sure it doesn't happen to you. Within, I don't know the exact time scale, days or maybe a couple of weeks of that conversation, I was brought in to the senior management of the unit I was on, and I was told, we're shutting the unit down, the investigation that you're on, right? It was an operation. And I said, why? And they said, well, we can't afford to second you. But it was the nonsense, so I probed deeper, and then he folded, this senior officer, and he said, look, John, I've got to be honest with you, because I like you. He said, it's come from very high up. It's all got shut down. And he said, we can't argue it. I'm really sorry. So I was asked to stay on this unit, but I didn't want to. So I moved, and I moved on to a very elite unit called the Clubs and Vice Unit. And it dealt with everything, really, from illegal gaming right down to street prostitution. So I went on there, and I had an incredibly successful time there, as I had most of my career, without sounding the slightest bit conceited, because I like to think I'm not. And I was asked to look into an allegation made by a young teenage girl that she, for many years, had been pimped out. And I was told, go and speak to her. She's made allegations in the past. Probably she's lying. She's a bit of a nightmare. See what she's got to say and then go from there. Well, I went to see this girl in a care home in Cambridgeshire. And, you know, she was a bit rough around the edges because, you know, she'd come from the care system and a bit of a tough life girl. But there was a bit of rapport between us. And she started to talk openly. And she said, look, it's been going on. There's a woman, as a prostitute, that was pimping this young girl out. So, but it's not just me, John. There's others. There's other girls, and some are younger than me. So she gave us a statement, and fantastic, very brave girl, what she was doing, because also they was giving these kids crack cocaine and heroin, and there was an organised crime element to this. And the police had known about this woman that was running it for a long time. And so this young girl gave me another young girl, who gave me another, and on it went. It went like that, and it just kept every day. It was just, it was snowballing. I mean, it went from a handful into double figures in no time at all. But then it started exposing some of the clients, other people that were involved. There was rumours of a judge involved. There was rumours of a police officer involved. There was rumours of people high up. Some of the venues were very, very sort of affluent parts of London. And it was highly organised operation that had been going on for a long time. And these kids were taken from, sometimes they'd be going into crack houses and they were traded for crack rocks of cocaine, crack cocaine. So a girl could be traded for an hour for 10 rocks of crack cocaine and passed around a dirty, smelly crack house. And then an hour later, she'd be taken to a very upmarket Mayfair restaurant after hours and traded for £2,000 an hour. So this is what's going on. The only thing that was consistent were the children were all vulnerable and all from the care system.
Now, one of the worrying things about this, John, is that some of those kids may well have been taken away from their parents and put into the care system in order to so-called protect them.
Well, 99% of them, that was the case. They were taken from an abusive environment, domestically abusive environment, to a place of safety. And then, of course, these vultures were waiting for them.
But the trouble is that those environments aren't always abusive. Nowadays, kids can be taken away from their parents for all sorts of reasons through the secretive family court. Some, even because the parents don't have enough money to look after the children, they can find them taken off them and in the care system.
Well, I can expand on that because with this operation, I was silenced. I drafted a report and what was going on, and I was told in no uncertain terms by a very high-ranked officer, keep your effing mouth shut, John. And I couldn't believe it. And then he threatened me. He said, if this ever gets out, we're destroyed, past, present, future. He swore, he didn't use them exact words. But then he went on to say, if you ever mention a word of this, and bear in mind, since 2000, I've been a single parent of four children and working as a, you know, as a frontline police officer. So, and he knew this, and he said, you mention it, you will lose your home, your job and your children. You've got to shut your mouth. So I left that unit and they massively scaled down that operation and they just focused on one kid who, unfortunately, she was the one who gave the initial information, was found dead in suspicious circumstances very shortly afterwards, right? But then I moved on to a child protection unit over in sort of East London way, north and East London. And then what you're saying about kids for other reasons getting taken into care. And what I found was that the children's home, take the borough of Haringey, for instance, you know, it goes from quite wealthy areas like Muswell Hill to very impoverished areas of South Tottenham. And it's a very small borough, and it's got 22 children's homes, which is a huge amount of kids' homes. And I visited every single one. Every single one of them had children that went missing. A vast percentage, over half of them that were resident, were going missing at a weekend. And the people who worked there believed that those kids were involved in prostitution, as in fact they were. One home had seven kids, and five of them were getting pimped out the weekend. But then when the kids are coerced into this horrendous lifestyle, what is happening then? There is an inducement for them to get their friends involved. And then, so how they would do that is some of the girls, mainly girls, but boys as well, would get their friend and say, look, come with us. You can make a lot of money. And then there was sort of like the drugs involved. But also no one will tell you what to do if you get in a care home, you get your own room. So some of the kids were actually making up allegations against their parents to be put in care. I must admit that was a small percentage. I'm not saying that was a norm, but that did happen.
Now, you mentioned threats against you, your house, your job, your sons.
Yeah.
And something did happen to your son, didn't it? What was that? Was that suspicious or not?
No, it wasn't suspicious because it was unrelated. But what it was, this shows the mentality of a so-called benevolent society, institution. Because what happened was I made official complaint of corruption against three senior officers in the Metropolitan Police.
Can you name them?
No, and I'll tell you what, I need to clear this up. I can't name them only because I'm due in court in the summer of next year with a civil case against them. And I've been advised by my barrister and by my solicitor that the case will be terminated if I name names now. And I've been warned by my barrister that I go down the lines of contemptuous behaviour.
Fine.
So I'm not going to risk that. Anyway, so I won't do that. But I mean, what I did was I spoke out. I didn't speak out against the senior officers per se. I spoke out against a fractured system, a deliberately corrupt and broken system, which has allowed these children to be treated in this manner. And I highlighted it. I can highlight it graphically as well when I give a presentation out. These agencies can legitimately walk away from the problem and not deal with it. And it's just appalling. It's almost Dickensian.
So what happened to your son?
Well, what happened was that I made this allegation in July of 2014. Now, very serious criminal allegation I made, and I was meant to be afforded protection. But then the Metropolitan Police then decided to look into me. So there was a campaign to silence me. And so over the next 3.5 years, there was 9 attempts to get me before a court for various criminal charges, all of which were dropped, all of which were... they were going through my emails like 10 years past to try and find something to discredit and to rubbish me, which seems to be a typical trait when you speak to victims and survivors of abuse, but also other whistleblowers. So there was this campaign. Now, through that campaign, not only were they trying to prosecute me, and a policeman's biggest fear is jail, a copper going to jail is a dead man walking, and they know this. So every time they tried to do me for gross misconduct, they would send papers to their internal investigations and they'd send them to the CPS. So there was each offence had two ways of dealing with it. One would get you sacked and the other one would get you sacked and imprisoned. So that's that. But they also stopped paying me. So I nearly lost my home. Now, bear in mind the threat. You'll lose your home, your job, and your children. I nearly lost my home on quite a few occasions, and the bank actually sat down with me. And when they realised what was happening, they were actually quite supportive. My job, well, I've just explained about that. Now, my children. Now, what happened in last year, in March of last year, the campaign was really in its high height against me. It really was taking momentum, what they were doing to me. One of my children was involved in a life-changing and catastrophic accident in which his spinal column was severed by 90%. He wasn't expected to survive. He did. He survived the initial operation and he remained in an intensive care unit, a phenomenal hospital in Cambridge, and I live miles away from Cambridge, but it was the centre of excellence for this injury for many months. I get a call one night, about 3 a.m. I've just come back from the hospital, which, again, I had no money. So I was sleeping in my car in the hospital car park. I couldn't even afford the parking for the car park. So what I did was I became a blood donor. And they gave me a little I'm a blood donor badge sticker, which I stuck in my windscreen. And I managed to park in the blood donor's car park and sleep there. I just had no money at all. So I get home. The hospital called me up. The consultant says, please, can you come back? So I said, everything all right. He said, please come back. Anyway, I travelled nigh on 100 miles to the hospital. And when I get there, there's two consultants and they've told me that they'd lost my son. He'd been dead for 7.5 minutes. They've managed to get a heartbeat, an algorithm back. He's on 100% life support. He's been dead for too long. They don't expect him to survive. And I was then asked if I would sign a form to turn off life support if it goes beyond. It was something like 5 days because they can't keep ventilating at 100% a young lad's lungs because they'll just damage them irreparably and he'll die anyway. And then you're looking at organ harvesting and things like that. So as far as I'm concerned, at that point, my son was dead, but there was a bit of brain pattern and there was a bit of a heartbeat. So medically, he was alive. So I sat with him, held his hand for 3 days. During that period of time, a colleague of mine, now the other thing I want to say when people whistleblow, it's a bit like a gangster who goes to prison. You're on your own. None of my colleagues, bar one, stood by me. Well, there was two actually. Everyone rode for the hills. Total disassociation from me and what I was involved in. And so one of them actually went to my senior officer at the time and said, why are you doing this to him? You know, the man, we're worried about him. He can't carry on like this. And told him about what was happening and said, look, he's lost his son. They've got him back, but he's not expected to live beyond the end of that week. Now, on the third day, miraculously, and my son's recovery was classed as miraculous, he woke and he showed signs of response and he opened his eyes and he could actually mouth a few words. So after 3 days, I was mentally and physically drained. I went home. When I got home, I got in. I was tired. I was worn out. My oldest son was arguing with two men outside my house. So I said, what's going on? He went, one of them said, are you John Wedger? My boy went, they keep asking for you. He said, I'm telling them you're not here. And he wasn't going to let him in. He's a big lad, my oldest boy. And he said, "Won't let me in." I said, look, let him in. There were two detectives from Hertfordshire Constabulary, been sent on request by the Metropolitan Police to arrest me and investigate me for child neglect and abandonment. Because in them 3 days, I'd left at home, my oldest boy, who's just not short of 30 years old, home with my 16-year-old lad. And they deemed my 16-year-old lad to have been neglected. So instead of sitting there and doing something benevolent, that is what they did. They tried to implement care proceedings against me and the only child that they could, because the Children's Act's been extended to 18 years old now, my 16-year-old boy. So this is a mark of what I don't want to swear, but this is what they will do in order to silence you. Now, all of this was done under the supervision of Cressida Dick. So she was well aware of what was going on as well. So she's not one of them I'll be naming in calls because it went on before that. But when you see them on television and they're sort of telling them about these three words, open, honesty and transparency, you know, they are failing the public. The most precious thing we have are our children. If you destroy your children physically, emotionally and spiritually, you destroy your society. Now, what I do now is I campaign tirelessly for the protection of police whistleblowers. Now, I need to explain that because people say, why the police? The police are different, unique, in as much as they're not subject to employment law. They hold the terms of office. So basically, their employer, the Met Police, the commissioner or chief constable can do what the hell they want to them, and they have no recourse to justice. Now, a lot of serious crime against children, the police, it has to go through their hands. The police heavily compartmentalise everything and they manage that information. They gatekeep it. Now, if these officers, these brave officers that speak out, and there are quite a few, against the cover-ups and abuse of children, then justice is never given to the victims and survivors of abuse. And so now, to show how much of a positive response I've had, most of the people I engage with now have come from, and it almost sounds derogatory, the criminal classes. A lot of them have been inside. They've got criminal convictions. Some of them are incredibly dangerous. One guy's a convicted murderer, right? You know, an ex-organised gangster, all sorts. And I have worked in harmony alongside all of them. And ordinarily, never the twain shall meet with these two communities. But we've not got a problem because we're coming at it from the same point of view. Because without ranting, Tony, when you look at the stats, 75% of the prison population have come from abuse childhood backgrounds. Now, there's a plethora of abuse that they'll come under, but, you know, there'll be a huge percent that have been sexually abused.
Now,
that, in turn, causes a lot of resentment and anger. And then when we look at drug addiction as well, you're looking near enough the same percentage. And so it is the rot in society.
Now, look, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, some of the maybe the driving forces behind this. One certainly is possible is blackmail, because if you can get somebody who has been a child sexual abuser and then propel them into some position of high office or power, then they'd be very easy to blackmail. In fact, you will then have control of that person, effectively. I mean, have you come across any evidence of any people like that that may have been the blackmail subjects?
Well, yeah, I mean, I will go on to others, but with me, I mean, it was a form of blackmail. Had they got anything dirty on me, they would use it against me, but they didn't, so they had to manufacture something. But when we look at a very honourable guy called Mike Veal, the chief constable, as was then, of Wiltshire Constabulary, he implemented the investigation against Ted Heath. Now, they did all they could to try and shut Mike Veal up. More recently, they've, I think it was a Daily Mail, accused Mike Veal of being a liar because he'd broken his work mobile telephone in a golfing accident, and then claimed that he dropped it. So it was like a minor sort of discrepancy. So that's all they had. So they then had to then smear him in the national media to say, if this man lies about a little thing like this, what else would he lie about?
But what about the use of blackmail by, by paedophiles in order to basically blacken the name of somebody that then could maybe find their way into high office and then be manipulated?
If you take what we call the vetting system, so in the police service, if you start going to the very secure sort of jobs, and I did have one of them, you get vetted. So they will then go through all your personal circumstances, and they need to know everything about you. They need to know all your sexual partners. They need to know your medical history, even your financial history. So anything that's dirty can be used against you, i.e. blackmailed, because you're going to end up in compromised situations. And one of the things that was said to me was that, and this was said by a female sergeant, that quite a few officers that are homosexual, it's not political correctness or anything like that, and there's no way this is a homophobic rant, this is just what was said to me, fail the vetting because they could possibly be compromised due to their sexual history and the amount of sexual partners they've had. So if we look at that, then we take people like Ted Heath, and I've taken accounts of a couple of people now that remember Ted Heath from the day when he was just a parliamentarian. And he would cruise like the sort of gay hangouts for young men. So he would go, one of his favourite places was Jack Straw's Castle, the car park in Hampstead Heath, where he would go and pick up young boys that had come from the care homes. Now, he would have had, back then, Special Branch would have been made aware, you know, of what was going on. especially when he was moving up the political ladder, the hierarchy it is, then you would have start implementing protection officers. They would know what was going on. So this information would have been fed back into the system that this man is a bit of a loose cannon, and you know, what's going on with him? Yet he was allowed to hold the highest position of office, that being a prime minister, with such a monumental, checkered and perverted past, because he was procuring young boys for sex. Yet he was allowed to become a prime minister, and anyone who spoke out against it, we see what they do. They go out their way to absolutely destroy them. And what also we've seen, and I'm drawing a parallel with the way that I believe they knew a lot of this was going to come out well in advance, was the implementation of the 2003 Criminal Justice Act, which a section of it goes on about a person's bad character. Now, when someone years ago was in a Crown Court, they couldn't make any reference to their previous criminal history unless there were certain exemptions that applied, and they were very rare and they needed a lot of preparation. It was called similar fact evidence, and it's now been superseded by this Bad Character Act. So the Bad Character Act didn't just involve someone's bad character criminally. They could use information from a care home, from a school, from an employer. So a lot of, like we mentioned, people that have been subject to horrendous abuse and sexual abuse in childhood, there is a propensity for them to then self-medicate either via alcohol or via drugs. And the drug of choice, pretty much still now, it was heroin. And, you know, in order to sustain a heroin addiction, usually you've got to take on criminal activity such as shoplifting or prostitution or whatever. So you end up, on the whole, getting caught, getting arrested for minor petty theft. But that is classed as dishonesty. So when you go before a court as a witness, you are straight away tarred with the label of being a man or a woman of dishonest character. So we're seeing this a lot with these victims that are coming forward with allegations. They're being demonized straight away. And they might be drug addicts, they might be thieves, they might have lied in the past. But under our fairness system, we've got to give everyone a chance. And, you know, anyone that makes allegations of that severe nature, you know, you've got to stand by them allegations. And there's so many sort of threshold tests, you know, and in all the years of interviewing children and then many, many cases I've had, there was only one case where a kid was actually proved to be a liar. On the whole, people don't make these allegations up. There is no financial inducement for them that will ever be like a reparation for what they've been through.
Well, there's also the fact that you've got some people now being prosecuted themselves for coming forward. I mean, what effect is that likely to have on those who are thinking of going to the police?
Oh, it's horrendous. And anyone that's been through the Crown Court system as a witness or a victim, you know, they'll stand testimony to what an awful and appalling system it is, especially when you've got to talk about the abuse, the sexual abuse that you've endured. I mean, it's harrowing enough. I mean, there's special measures that can be put forward so people can give evidence via video links and stuff like that. But it's incredibly traumatic for them. And bear in mind, when we look at historical cases, when they are reported, you know, and the further away it was, the harder it is to get a successful prosecution. We're looking at only 2% of them that end up actually in a successful prosecution. So the work that the police have to put in, and these are on the whole very well trained and dedicated officers, and you know, and the fact that the victims and survivors of these really have to keep themselves together is a testimony to their truth.
Now, I mean, this is something that goes back a long, long way. I mean, we're talking about the 1980s, and Geoffrey Dickin, the MP, handing a supposed dossier saying that there were 12 serving and former parliamentarians that were child sexual abusers, and that was the dossier that then apparently went missing. Do you think there's any truth to that earlier allegation, and will this ever get properly dealt with, John?
Well, the first bit, I know one of the victims of horrendous abuse that went to Geoffrey Dickins. I know the woman very well, and she speaks incredibly highly of him. a man of total integrity. And I know that since then, Tom Watson has tried to pick up the gauntlet on that. There's another MP who stood by Mike Beale, the chief constable, and he's been told, carry on involving yourself in all this and your political career will go no further. So they're getting bullied from within. In response to the second part, Tony, will it ever get out? We're seeing it. We're seeing a cohesion now. We're seeing people come together and take my scenario, for example. You know, the fact that victims and survivors are happy and comfortable working with me, being an ex-copper, the fact that I've even linked in with elements of ex-organised criminals that are happy talking at me about the corruption, the cover-ups, the fact that more coppers are coming forward. I've got a meeting with the Secretary of State's office in the new year. We've got a letter writing campaign to back what we're doing as police whistleblowers. You know, we're seeing what was once classed as incredulous now becoming acceptable. And for example, and I like to always evidence what I say, if you go back into maybe two decades ago and you mentioned about Jimmy Savile being a paedophile and a necrophiliac, you know, and that his involvement with the royal family and parliament, everything else, you would have been laughed at. You'd have actually probably been shouted down. And I always remember speaking in the CID office about Jimmy Savile, and he came on Sky News or something, and I said, that man is a pedo. And my detective sergeant laughed at me and went, what are you on about, you effing idiot? And then years later, she actually sent me an email apologising. So, you know, Jimmy Savile was a saint. He built hospitals, you know. He cured children. He did this. He created miracles. Yet, you know, the truth has come out and now it's acceptable. Now, if Jimmy Savile, who was an incredibly evil man, and I really think this was an act of God exposed him, because it has started something. It has pushed the ball downhill and it's rolling faster and faster each second. Now, we've got to get our heads out of all the nonsense on the telly. We've got to look at our society and we've got to really look at the facts of this, that the tentacles of this have spread everywhere. And we are starting to see it. And not only that, this sort of term conspiracy theorist is really not that toxic anymore.
Now, just a minute, some people have made allegations of links to Freemasonry. Obviously, this is a secret society. There have been several Scotland Yard reports that link Freemasonry to infiltration of Scotland Yard by organised crime. Do you think there's any actual evidence of Masonic involvement with this child sex abuse cover-up?
Well, what we've got to look at, it's very similar to the argument of, like, Muslim grooming gangs. Right, so you're getting a lot of stuff about Muslim grooming gangs, Muslim grooming. Well, like I said on an interview recently, well, let's really look at who actually does groom. And this is linked to Masonry, don't worry. When we look at the majority of people that groom, it's parents that groom and pimp out their children. We're being sidetracked. I'm not saying the Muslim thing doesn't go on. Of course it goes on, and it's gone on with impunity in a lot of provincial parts of the UK. But what about the other institutions, you know, like church institutions, the care institutions? You know, we've got to look at everything in its entirety. Now, has there been a Masonic influence? Well, we'll never know. And you tell me what part of anything hasn't had a Masonic influence. But the real secret society here, yeah, are the paedophiles. This is when you get proper secrecy, because, you know, you're talking every single swathe of society. You're talking from every religion, every economic background, every social strata, you know, these paedophilia is what connects them. Masonry, it's an oath within an oath in the police. And has it had a detrimental effect? Well, I'd say openly, probably it has. But again, you'll never know. And I would say there's a lot of coppers that are Masons, and I would have thought a lot of them have no idea what they're really involved in. But I would say the higher up, you know, the food chain you go in this institution, I would have thought it would be pretty evident what's going on, you know?
when you joined the police, you said it's an oath within an oath. So what you're saying is, I swear an oath to serve the Queen and the country, but then you're swearing another oath to serve somebody else. So how on earth can that be compatible with public office?
Well, it can't. It can't. And they have tried to highlight. I think it was Paul Condon that tried to bring in a mandate to say that all officers must declare that their links to secret society, and he just got laughed out of office for it. But it will be everywhere. I mean, it'll cross over into, the medical industry. It will cross over into social services and all sorts. But like I said, I think the biggest secret society is the paedophilic society. And
okay, can we just round?
That involves women as well.
Can we just round off then by, if anyone's listening, knows someone or themselves has been sexually abused, there are all sorts of questions people will be in people's heads before they go to the police. Well, what would you advise they do?
Well, unfortunately, things have changed within the police. It's not how it used to be. And I say that in a negative way, because they used to always have a front office where that was the first point of call. Your ultimate prosecuting agency for the time being is going to be the police. They've lost a lot of skill, they've lost a lot of professionalism, they lost a lot of what they call tradecraft. The police, especially when it comes to child abuse, they're very well trained. Well, they were when I was there. They're overworked, but they're very dedicated, well-trained officers. And ultimately, if you report anything, it's going to go to, the front desk or whatever it is, even online. But it will be passed on to a specialist crime child abuse investigation team. And then you'll be interviewed. But what I'll say is that just don't be frightened. Don't be frightened. And someone said to me once, have you never been frightened? Are you never scared with what you've done? And I always say, what is my fear, Tony, in comparison to that of a young kid that's hiding under his covers? That's real fear. So don't be frightened. These people aren't the big monsters you think. Get them in the court. Let's get them in the court. Let's get them exposed. Let's get the houses turned over. Find out what's on their hard drives. Find out who they're connected with and everything else. And this is a wound that needs opening up. It needs a scab peeling off and it needs healing. And the only way we do this is to sometimes, face the truth. And it's going to be painful for a lot of people. But if we can get one paedophile behind bars, then he can't hurt anyone else or her else, because women commit sex acts against kids as well as men. So just be brave and may God be with you, because I'll certainly always back you up. But we need the public to start pushing that this is an area of policing that needs massive funding. We need the whistleblowers protected and we need the whole system shaking up. And we need to get together as one big national community. We pay enough money in our taxes. We need our children protecting. And that's, and if it's happened to someone, God bless you, but let's try and stop it happening to the next generation.
Former Metropolitan Police Detective John Wedger. That's Wedger. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen to the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Matthew Alford from Bath University, author of Union Jackboot, What Your Media and Professors Don't Tell You About British Foreign Policy, just out, and John Wedger, that's Wedger, Detective Constable, former John Wedger. Also, thanks to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897, and they're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some spare time, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, where you'll find us. That's at do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
All lips to see you.